Thanks, buddy. Hey, what's up, everybody? Michael W. Alcoholic. Grateful to be here. Thanks for having us out here. Like you said, my home group is the New Frontier Wednesday night on Bayview Boulevard in Norfolk, Virginia. We have Wednesday night at 7 p.m. and we also have a meeting, United We Stand, on Sunday nights at 5:30 p.m. I also have a virtual home group, which is Tidewater Late Night. We meet virtually from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. 7 days a week. My sober date is July 14th, 2024, so I just hit a year a couple weeks ago. And kind of hit the ground running with this recovery. So I'm going to share a little bit about what it was before, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm going to take it back to my childhood because that played a big key in a lot of the reasons why I got to where I was going. My mother was 16 when she had me. My dad was 18 years old. He pretty much up and split when he found out my mom was pregnant and left her to have a kid at a very young age. Both of them were still living with their parents. So my mother had me and kept me around for about 3 years. When she turned 18 years old, she just became too much for her, and she hit the road and took off from her parents' house and left me behind. So I went through the whole adoption process. My grandparents fought to take me in as a foster child until they were able to ultimately adopt me. Wasn't really a whole lot of drinking with my grandparents when I was growing up. It was just a lot of working. He was a truck driver and she worked for the city. So I was really kind of left to myself quite a bit of my childhood. You know, getting to and from school because it was walking distance, making my own food, doing my own laundry, kind of just fending for myself. And any close relatives that were close by just kind of checked in on me periodically. Fast forward a little bit after that, they ended up going through a divorce. And it kind of shook me because not only did my birth parents kind of dip out, I kind of felt like my adoptive parents, which were my grandparents, were doing the same. Kind of torn between which one do I go with. My biological mother had since moved back into the house where my dad was, my grandfather, and she told me, you know, I'll come back around if you stay here in Florida, and you know, I'll be around, I'll be a part of your life. And soon after, I realized that wasn't the case. She hit the road again and kind of left me. And it became the trend. You know, she would come back around in my life, stick around, and then soon after, she would leave again. So I dealt with a lot of abandonment stuff. I would take my pictures up off the wall in my family's house. I would scratch my face out of the pictures. Or I would cut myself out of the pictures because I felt like I was just a burden to everybody. So it really kicked off the depression. Started hanging out with some of the wrong kids. My brother, which is technically my uncle, was closest to me in age. He's 6 years older than me, so I got to see and hang out with quite a bit of his friends, drinking and chewing Copenhagen and living out on a farm in northern Florida was the way to go, you know. We just snuck it. We would go down to the end of any dirt road or we'd be on our farm and, you know, nobody really said anything to us. So I just kind of stuck with them. I wanted to be like them. I wanted to hang out with them. I wanted to feel accepted somewhere, and that's where I felt accepted. And it just started getting bad. You know, the depression was starting to kick in. I started running away from home, trying to run away from my problems, and kept feeling that that void of you know, the family or belonging. And ultimately, my aunt, my biological mother's older sister, stepped in when I was about 15 years old, and she took guardianship of me. It was a Navy family, so I got the experience of going to Hawaii and California, and then ultimately we went up to Nova right out of D.C., because he was at the Pentagon. So I got a taste of what the military life could provide for a family. The structure, everything, you know. So I knew the military was going to be somewhat part of my life because I had seen the way it had benefited them. And 9/11 had just happened. And all my friends that I had been around were already up and gone. Delayed entry program and took off. I was still left behind there in high school for a couple years before it was my time. But my first real trouble with alcohol ended up happening while I was in high school. My senior year was homecoming. They did the powder puff game where the guys dress up as a cheerleader and the girls are the football players. Well, we had a party scheduled after school. We were going to go over there, hang out pregame, and get dressed up and then go to this football game. So my bright idea was that I was going to put the liquor and alcohol that I did have stashed in a backpack and I was going to take it to school with me. Then come lunchtime, I decided to hit up one of my close friends and said, hey man, let's go take a shot. In between classes, nobody will get us, right? So we walk out there, the campus police end up seeing us walk out to the vehicle and walk right back into school. So soon after, I got in trouble for possession of alcohol on school grounds, and I'm grateful that's all they found in my vehicle. But that's a different subject. So, you know, I had to go through that getting suspended. I was scared I wasn't going to graduate, but I was very great at track and cross country and all these sports throughout high school. And I started to gain attention. You know, I was going to state, I was going to national, and I was starting to feel this groove of look at all these people looking at me. I'm in newspaper articles for, you know, breaking school records and stuff like this. And I had just threw all that down the drain, getting in trouble at school. Thankfully, the military did not frown too much on that. I went and talked to a Navy recruiter soon after, you know, I got all that squared up, and I was talking to him, and he pulled out this cruise book, and the cruise book just shows, like, their deployment and all the stops they had stopped at. It's all these countries, man. It's beautiful. And they're out here on this big ship out in the ocean going all over the world. I'm like, I want to go see the world. You know, I had been stuck in Florida a good chunk of my life. But in the cruise book, he had this picture of these guys shooting their rifles off the back of the boat or climbing or room clearing or doing all this other stuff. And I said, I want to do that job. He's like, well, I hate to break it to you, that's the Marines, and their office is next door. And I said, well, thank you kindly for your time. I'm going to go next door and talk to them. So soon after I did, I joined the United States Marine Corps. I did the delayed entry program. I chose an infantry option because 9/11 had just happened. That's what my friends took off to do. So I wanted to go fight the fight and take the war to the Taliban. So that's what I did. It took off. Soon after I graduated high school, I was in Beaufort, South Carolina at Parris Island. And it is a great vacation spot. I'm joking. But yeah, my drill instructors gave me a big old hug when I got there. It was tough. It was 3 months of hell. But I still had that mindset that you know, I excelled so much in these sports and stuff, and I was getting all this recognition. It just carried over to my military time. So during that 3 months, I grinded as hard as I could. From the time I stepped off that bus onto those yellow footprints in Parris Island, I was the guide. I was that guy. The drill instructors thrashed me daily all the way until it came time for graduation. And I found out that I was going to be the honor graduate. So out of 300-400 guys out of my graduating class, I was the one standing dead center. And I had the honor of calling my family and telling them of my accomplishments at boot camp, and that they got to sit VIP with the base generals dead center in front of everybody. And they would be able to get, they would be given an award for my job there at Parris Island. And man, it just sparked that fuel in my head even more, like, look what I could do. So graduated there, took off, went to the School of Infantry in North Carolina, and big surprise, I graduated honor grad from there. I got a letter of accommodation, didn't get promotion because I just got one from boot camp. Left there, I went to Light Armor Reconnaissance School in San Diego. Once again, graduated honor grad, got another meritorious promotion. By the time I hit the fleet, I was an E3, which is unheard of, especially in my line of work. But soon after that, I took off on a deployment. And I found my niche. I found my family. I found my sense of purpose, the camaraderie and the esprit de corps and the brotherhood I felt going through those hard times with those guys, it just solidified, like, everything I had been looking for. I deployed a couple times. I went out on a couple Navy boats, got to go see Egypt, Africa, Europe, Middle East, South America. I've been to well over 30 different countries in a very short span of time. But it kind of boiled down to my last deployment. My last deployment was in Afghanistan. It was in Marja province, southern Afghanistan, right close to the Pakistani border. And we were attached to a reserve unit, 4th LAR. March 31st and April 1st will forever be ingrained in my mind. That was the day that I lost quite a few of my friends. And when I say that, I'm talking about within arm's distance of me, picking them up and putting them on a helicopter and remembering the times that we had cookouts at their house with their wives and their kids and family events, because that's what it was. We were family. When you shed blood, sweat, and tears with these guys, it really solidifies that relationship between us. Brother was just, and most definitely was the epitome of that relationship. So it really hurt. We didn't have time to grieve because we were still in a combat zone. We were still getting shot at. We were still getting blown up. So we powerhoused through it. At the end of our tour there, we did a little left seat, right seat with the oncoming unit. And we did a service there with everybody that was there in the war zone in Afghanistan, because we missed the funerals. We didn't get to come home and see our friends off. So we did it overseas. So came home and just started drinking. You know, we came home, we made it, you know, we got back home, we're drinking to our buddies that had passed away. And about August, so I came back the end of May. By August, my mother had overdosed and passed away, my biological mother. And all the time, I had put pieces together that's what it was, why my mother was in and out of my life, was because she was an addict. And she was coming home to her parents' house to recoup and regenerate or whatever she needed, funds, you know, a place to live because she didn't have anywhere to be, and then she would hit the road again when she had what she needed. And it all made sense in that moment when she had overdosed and passed away. And I kind of beat myself up because I never got to, I never forgave her. I never gave her the opportunity. I always just called her Lisa. I never called her mother. And she was gone. And I had no way of, mending that relationship with her. My adopted mother, my grandmother as well, I did pass that up. She passed away a few years before she did as well from a heart attack. So of course the two mothers I had in my life were gone. And then I had a combat deployment where I lost friends, and I had no way. They don't teach you how to cope with that when you come back from overseas. You know, I'm 22, 23 years old over there slinging rounds down range and getting shot at and blown up. And you come home and they tell you to just act normal. I don't know what normal is, and I don't know what their idea of normal is, because it's a lot to deal with. I couldn't imagine a 22-year-old kid nowadays going through some of that that we endured. So I turned to drinking, man, and then I got married, slowed down on my drinking, had a beautiful daughter, had a family going. I was like, all right, cool. I'll only drink on the weekends. I'll only stick to beer, or, you know, oh, we got to do this. So I'll take a break. It's getting too much. I'll take a 30-day break. Something else will happen. Boom, I'm back off to the races again. Marriage fell apart. Custody battle. And I did a geographical before I even knew what a geographical was. I packed my stuff and left North Carolina and moved here because my family was still here, still in the Navy. And bounced out of in and out of jobs, man. Got a DUI. I also had one while I was in. I skipped that. But at that point, I had two DUIs, one in North Carolina, one in Virginia. I gave it a little more time, and I decided to get another one. So three in total DUIs in a very short stint of time. I just kept getting depressed. I was losing jobs. I couldn't keep a driver's license. So I was like, where can I go? I had moved into Ocean View, and I lived right across the street from a bar. Walking distance. I could throw a rock and hit this place. I was like, oh, this is perfect, dude. I don't have to worry about drinking and driving no more. So walk into this place, I become a familiar face, and one night I'm sitting there, and the owner was behind the bar, bartender. I was like, what are you doing? She's like, well, I had a couple of the other bartenders quit all in the same week. She's like, are you interested in bartending? And I'm like, oh, yes, let's do this. I can bartend, I know how to drink them. I'm sure I can figure out how to make them real quick. And that's what I did. I did that for years, man. And it was great. I could sneak shots behind the bar. Customers would buy them for me. Other items, if I wanted, would be slid to me underneath the napkin or whatever. And I could go to the bathroom and perk back up and be right back behind the bar and kick away at it. And it was great. I'm not going to lie. I love the feeling of having people come to the bar and be like, hey, Mike, you know, that's my best bartender right there. We travel all over to come see this guy. It was awesome. You know, I was having events, karaoke nights, pool tournaments, all kinds of stuff. I mean, it was just amazing the amount of people that would just travel to come see me while I was working. So that ego just kept freaking growing. I was unstoppable. The owner would catch me on camera drinking and just come give me like a little pat on the hand. But I was making her so much money, having all these events and stuff, it was just swept under the rug. That all came to a pretty quick screech. About 2 years ago, I was at work and I started having an intense pain in my abdomen. Felt like somebody jabbed me with an ice pick and just started swirling my stomach around. I didn't know what was going on. I'm freaking out. I called the owner of the bar. I was like, hey, I got to shut this place down. I got to go to the hospital. She's like, oh, you're fine. You're probably just hungover. Go get a Red Bull out of the freezer, drink it, and you'll be fine. I'm like, geez, you know, now looking back, I'm like, I had already created enough rhythm of excuses and stuff over the past that she already just naturally assumes it was a hangover. So I hung up, I drank that Red Bull, and about another hour after that, I was in the emergency room, and then soon after that, I was rushed into emergency surgery. I had diverticulitis and I had ruptured. And the whole time that I was drinking and doing all that stuff, I was slowly leaking my stomach stuff into the cavity of my stomach. And my organs were slowly shutting down. So they cut me 16 inches down my stomach, took 6 inches of my large intestine and part of my colon and put a colostomy bag on me. For about 6 months, I had that colostomy bag and I was miserable. They gave me pain pills and sent me home after that surgery, told me, you know, what to eat, what not to eat, how to change the colostomy bag, and watch your drinking, because that was a big contributing factor to the reason this happened. In my alcoholic mind, I seen pain pills. So that's what I went home and did. I abused the hell out of those pain pills, and when I ran out, I got them off the street, and I washed them down with a bottle of whiskey because I was embarrassed that I had a colostomy bag and I had got myself to this point. And I just counted down the days until I would have to go back to surgery or get to go back to surgery to have this colostomy off, because that was my next focus. How quick can I get this thing off my stomach? So I made it. I was still drinking, passing out, having a colostomy bag bust open all over me, washing my sheets constantly because I was still drinking myself to blackout majority of those nights. And then I just played my clock all the way up until the night before the surgery. I knew that I had to stop at a certain time to make sure I had no alcohol in my system, because that's what the doctor told me. If I showed up intoxicated, they would not do the surgery. So I mapped it out. I stopped exactly at the time I said I was going to stop, and went to the hospital and was on the edge of the freaking gurney praying that I had did my math right and that they would still do the surgery. Thankfully, they did. I had the reversal on the colostomy, and they gave me some more pain pills and sent me back home. So that vicious cycle just started again. I just didn't have to worry about the colostomy bag. I just had to worry about keeping everything clean for the scar to heal up. And it just kept going, man. It kept going and going and going. I got more depressed and depressed and depressed. And I was just done. I was mentally and physically done, and I was ready to kill myself. I came up with a plan. I was ready to do it. And I said, you know what, I had swam out into the Chesapeake Bay as far as I could until I could faintly hear my friends' voices screaming at me to swim back, because I knew I was too weak to pull the trigger on a gun. So I was just going to drown myself. I was going to swim until I couldn't swim anymore and hopefully just disappear. And I was floating in the Chesapeake Bay, trying to catch my breath, just sobbing, crying, looking up at the moon, just praying. And something came over me in that moment of looking up at the moon. I don't know exactly what it is. I would say that it was a spiritual awakening or experience in that moment. My higher power telling me it's not my time. But I swam back to the beach and I called my best friend, Ben. And Ben had already been sober for a little bit. He's a Navy veteran. He retired out a few years before. He was a bartender as well. We met, we clicked, same music, same clique of people. He was a great dude, but he had quit drinking. He had a month and some change of sobriety time. He wasn't working a 12-step program, but he had found a way to quit drinking. And he was one of the guys that was right there next to me, slinging down drink after drink. So I was like, man, I need help. I'm like, I'm ready to end this if I can't get a hold of this. And he talked me down, man. He talked me into the idea of going to rehab, if that's really what it needed to take, if I couldn't kick it on my own or with going to AA meetings. And in my head, I already didn't want to go to AA meetings. So I went to a 60-day treatment at the VA hospital. Since I'm a veteran, I was just the right idea to go. So I went and did a 60-day treatment, and I was about 35 days into that treatment, and Ben, of course, was still sober, but a 22-year-old young kid decided to drink and drive that drink that night on August 18th. It's coming up on the 18th of this month. But that 22-year-old kid struck and killed my best friend drinking and driving while I was at rehab. And it was devastating, but I just kept playing through my head how much he made an influence on me making that decision. To go get help. So the rehab kicked me out on a pass. I got to go to his funeral, and I'm sitting there. You know, I got 30-something days with no drinking, and I'm watching all my friends drink in honor of our friend that just got struck and killed by a drunk driver that was already trying to set the example of what sobriety could be in your life. And my friends were just drinking through it. People were coming up, oh, we're so proud of you, Mike, and then they'd hide their beer bottles behind their back like I was going to yank it out of their hand. And in my head, I'm thinking, are you guys really that sick in your head that our friend just got struck and killed by a drunk driver and he was trying to set the example. So I went back to rehab, did not pick up a drink by the grace of God. Went back to treatment, I completed that. I did 12 weeks of aftercare. Came home from that and, you know, a series of other events happened, but I want to kind of get to the good stuff. I bounced around a couple places, lived in a sober home for a little bit, and now I'm in a phenomenal place, living with a sober friend, and got a home group and started going to meetings. Some of the guys in these rooms, this room right now, met me day one. And they said 90 days, 90 meetings. They took me by the hand, walked me. Just when I thought there wasn't anything that could help, it was here. So I started going to meetings every day. I was doing multiple meetings a day. I was utilizing Zoom while I was in rehab, so I had known about that. The meeting guide and everything AA, and I was getting up in the morning, hitting my knees, praying and doing a Zoom meeting, and then I was doing another Zoom meeting, and then I was in an in-person meeting, and then at the end of the day, I was in another Zoom meeting, and I just kept doing it because I didn't want to pick up. And I kept following these guys around. The ones that were setting the example for how to do this program. You know, I got a home group and then I got a virtual home group and started working through the steps and honestly sitting down and looking at myself. And that biggest thing, you know, asking another guy to help you was huge. Now he's a big part of life. So we worked through the steps, and now I get to utilize these steps in my everyday life. It's changed so much. I went from being able to be a part of my daughter's life and, you know, saying I would never be like my mother and my father were to me when I was a child, but I ended up doing it in my addiction. And it had severed that relationship with my daughter. I wasn't getting communication with her. I wasn't getting visitation. Everything was obsolete because I was too busy drinking. Last time I honestly really got to see my daughter, I was in a blackout. It was Christmas a few years back. Thankfully, my family was here to take care of my daughter because when they went to bed, I snuck out the back door and went to the bar down the street. And I would come home before when the bar closed and I would sleep most of the day and then I would do it all over again. And I was being exactly what I didn't want to be. But now this program teaches me how to live soberly so I could be what I should have been the whole time in my daughter's life. I've since, in recovery, been able to see my daughter. She came down for a cheer competition, and I got to see her, and I get to talk to her. And she, you know, she knows what's going on. I don't hide the fact of what I'm doing or where I'm at today. I used to hide a lot of it in my insecurities and my fear of how people would perceive me and all that stuff, and I don't have to live in that anymore. Because this program teaches me that. Since coming, I'm also a GSR for my virtual home group, so I'm starting to get to see a little bit of the bigger picture of Alcoholics Anonymous now. I'm getting to go to the conference, the assemblies, these meetings, and all this other stuff, and getting more involved in how we can carry this message to the next sick and suffering, or the newcomer that walks into these rooms. And it's been a blessing. Because I get to see these guys come in to the rooms now, and I get to sponsor guys. I have a few sponsees today that, you know, I get to talk to on a daily basis and go through that same journey I got to go through with my sponsor, and I still get to experience with my sponsor on a daily basis or weekly basis. So it's honestly been one of the most meaningful things in my life. With all that said that I had endured in my life, from childhood to Marine Corps to the surgery, coming in this room and picking up that white chip that's going to be offered later today has been the most meaningful thing in my life. And that's why I keep coming back. This reconnection with my higher power, hitting my knees and truly surrendering to a power bigger than myself and allowing him to guide me on this way of recovery. I've since been back to church. Recommitted myself in front of the congregation of the church that I claim as my church now. On Easter Sunday this past year. And I'm getting involved in my church. My church offers a 12-step program, faith-based. And the pastor sat me down one day on my year anniversary, actually. And he said, man, I see what you're doing. I've seen the change in you since you've been coming to church. I would love for you to go experience that and see if it would benefit our church and our congregation to bring something there. Wait, who? You want this guy to do it? The guy that was throwing up and taking shots in between dry heaving to stop dry heaving just a year ago? So this program can offer way more than you'll ever imagine. And I could say that because I've experienced it. So if you're struggling with your addiction, I challenge you to pick up that big book and get a sponsor and do those 90 and 90 and really take an honest look at yourself, because this can be that turning point in your life and get you back on track to where I should have been this whole time. So I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful for all of you to be here, or for all of y'all being here tonight and allowing me to share my story. And like I said, my name is Michael W. and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, guys.
Thanks again, Michael. That was a great story. Being that it's August, the eighth month, I have a home group member come up and talk about the eighth step. Steve, if you could.
We can record
you. Can you sign the release form?
Yes. Absolutely.
Good evening. My name is Steve Rowe.